Blacks make up just 12% of the population, but they are 77% of all the players in the NBA and 62% of all of the starters in the NFL, and they are pretty well paid. However, when you begin to look in greater depth at the situation, you see that there are ways in which black athletes are limited. For example, there are virtually no black Olympic swimmers. There are certain sports that the blacks just don't seem to get into. In addition, in the sports where there are a lot of black players, professional baseball and football, certain positions don't seem to have many black players. There are very few black catchers and, of course, very few black quarterbacks. In addition, in the time, and it's been quite a long time, that there have been professional sports teams, no professional sports team was ever owned by a black. It is a situation that concerns a lot of people, and we will talk about it this morning. We'll talk with Philip Hose, who is the author of this book and also the author of a couple of others, one of them about basketball in Indiana. That book is entitled Hoosiers, The Fabulous Basketball Life of Indiana. His other book is Building an Ark, which is about the conservation of endangered species. He makes his home in Maine and is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, you who are listening are invited to call in. Maybe you have some questions for us or some thoughts of your own to share. It's very easy to be a part of the conversation. Just pick up the telephone and call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois and Indiana and Kentucky and Iowa and all those other little bits of states that we get into. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Hose, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You say, you write in your book that there is sort of a basic rule, an unofficial rule of thumb that you'll see operating in sports. And actually, it has two points. One is that the nearer to where the ball usually is, the less likely it is that a black will occupy that position. And the more responsibility or control involved in the position, the less likely a black will play it. Give us some examples to illustrate how that's played out in sports.
Yeah, I think that last year's Major League All-Star game is a real good case in point. Now, this is a game that was heralded by Major League Baseball as a look at baseball's future, because 30 of the 56 players on both teams were there for the first time. If you break it down by position, in the outfield positions, the farthest away from the ball, the ones that are most reactive, in that outfielders just wait three or four or five times a game for someone to hit a ball, and then they run after it, catch it, throw it back in, 9 of the 11 outfielders in that game were black or Hispanic. As you move in closer in the infield, 14 of the 23 infield positions were white, including all 4 of the American League starters. The pitchers, the ones who initiate action, 19 of the 20 pitchers were white. Dwight Gooden was the only exception. And, of course, all 4 of the catchers were white. Football is very similar in that there were only 4 black quarterbacks in all the National Football League last year, over 26 teams. There were 2 centers, 2 black centers. And as you move outward from the ball, your chances to play a position and be black increase. I think 23% of the guards were black, 46% of the tackles, 90-some percent of the ends. And on defense, you were far less likely to play linebacker, which is the real center thought control position on the defense if you were black.
It seems ironic, you know, as we try to look at how in particular white coaches, owners, agents, even sports journalists think about black players, it's particularly ironic how over time the sort of genetic arguments have continually come into play and changed in the way that they were used. It's sort of strange that at the beginning, the sort of genetic argument was used to keep blacks out of certain sports, to say, well, you know, there are just some sports that black athletes can't do.
Right.
Later on, that was turned around to explain why some black athletes excelled at certain sports, that we went from saying that genetically they couldn't do it to the reason that they could do it was genetics, and that somehow we're at that point now and still where somehow where it's a denial of intelligence, that with black athletes we're saying that it's somehow something physical.
That's right. I mean, you never see scientists looking for black superior mentality. Nobody ever has a thesis that blacks do better in the NBA because they're smarter, or because they have more patience, or because they have more discipline or more character or anything like that. It's always a physical quest. There was even one study. Usually these studies have to do with bones and muscles and tendons and so forth. I've even seen them where the thesis had to do with eye color. One University of Pennsylvania scientist decided that the reason that blacks outnumbered whites in certain sports was because people with blue eyes were, quote, self-paced, and people with brown eyes were, I forget what he called them, active or something like that. But that was his reason for it. But always it's a quest for physical advantages. I mean, you make a great point about the shifting notions. One good example is the runner. Blacks, I think, of the last generation grew up believing, my editor, incidentally, at Random House is black, and he was among the ones who grew up believing that any black could out-sprint any white, but blacks couldn't run more than a half mile, any distance farther than a half mile. Well, now that Africans are doing so well in long-distance runners, it's now shifted to the notion that, well, there are two kinds of Africans. They're the ones with big muscles, they're the ones from the West, and they're the ones with little muscles and little hips and long legs and so forth, and they're the ones from the East, and it's a genetic, again, a genetic explanation for individual excellence. Another has to do with swimming, ankles. Among the many reasons that whites have offered for the absence of blacks in Olympic swimming, along with a general lack of buoyancy and nappy hair that retards the water, is a fixed ankle. You read about this in what passes for literature, that their ankles are fixed and they can't move as, they're not as limber as white ankles, and therefore they get kind of dragged down in the water. Well, now that a few black sprinters are emerging at the just sub-Olympic level, you hear those same ankles being used as an advantage, as an excuse. Well, they can jump farther off the blocks, and in a short race, that's a big advantage. So you really can't win.
Yeah, you talk about the fact that, you know, there are people who are doing research that does, in a sense, legitimize this kind of way of thinking. But another way that this gets transmitted, and probably transmitted's a good way to talk about it, is through sports journalists who seem to have different ways of talking about black and white athletes, although they, when you confront them with this, they would like to tell you that that's not true, but it seems that some study has been done, and that it is true that they talk differently about black athletes and white athletes.
Yeah, not long. There's been a good deal of linguistic analysis done on this. Just a few months ago, a columnist for the Boston Globe named Derek Jackson took a look at the linguistic content of 7 NFL playoff games and 5 NCAA basketball games during the 88-89 season, and he classified all the broadcasters' comments according to 4 categories. The first was he called it brawn, meaning running, leaping, size, quickness. The second was brains, or comments having to do with intelligence, leadership, motivation. The third was weakling, lack of speed or size. And the fourth he called dunce, being confused or out of emotional control. And he had people who had not watched or listened to those games compile the statistics for him. And what he found was that in football and basketball, while 60% of the starting players were black, black athletes got 87% of the brawn comments and 90% of all the dunce comments. Whites got 67% of the brain comments and 86% of all the weakling comments, comments like, you know, he doesn't have the physical talent. But I think it's an important phenomenon in sports, this differential description. Blacks are just described much more frequently in physical terms than whites in mental terms.
Mm. Our guest this morning on Focus 580 is Philip Hose. We're talking about his book, Necessities, Racial Barriers in American Sports. It's published by Random House. Maybe you have some questions or comments, or you will as we move along here. You're invited to call in locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The book is basically about the conditions for black athletes, the fact that certain positions and in certain sports you don't see many black athletes. One thing that you do also mention, though, is the fact that there aren't very many black sportscasters, sports journalists. Does that play a role here, and do you think perhaps if there were more blacks doing the play-by-play and sports commentary that we wouldn't have these kind of differences that you've been talking about?
Yeah, I really think so. I think that many of the network level broadcasters are white ex-coaches, guys who tend to be in their 50s and 60s. And when you talk to them about this, I interviewed some for the book, and they were quite defensive about it. I talked to Billy Packer and Dick Vitale, and they were quick to point out that they knew a lot of blacks, that growing up in sports, that they had known more black people, really, than the average white person does. But how do they really know these people? They know them by controlling them. That's the way coaches tend to know athletes. They know them by recruiting them, scouting them, shaping their futures, withholding the lifeblood of playing time or offering it. It's not a real natural way to get to know somebody. It's hard to be a good friend of your coach. And I think that in coaching and in scouting and recruiting, there are just pretty lazy attitudes about blacks. There's the basic presumption that blacks are innately superior athletes, and I think that Al Campanis was hardly unique in his presumption that blacks are mentally not up to par to really control something, that they're not to be trusted with control. And I think that these comments, they occasionally explode in an indiscretion into a microphone, but more typically they're just in the sort of semi-conscious language with which black and white players are used. I think it would help if there were more blacks in broadcasting.
Uh-huh. We have a caller here. We hope that we'll get some other people involved in the conversation here on one of our local lines. Let's bring them in here. Good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Excuse me, my son is badgering. Yeah. It's kind of, I find the topic very interesting, you know. But it's not just limited to sport. I think it's the whole historical thing. Come, you know, keeps coming back and back and forth. You know, it's I think it's reflected in the whole American society. For me, coming from Senegal, you know, I could see it. You know, I could just see it. It's just something that, you know, somebody doesn't have to tell you. You just have to. I guess I should say I'm the observer. I don't know if it's true or not, but I see all those things that the guy's talking about. I'm not trying to question his intelligence. He must be a very intelligent guy because all those things that he wrote, it takes a lot, you know, a lot of time, a lot of observation and things like that. But I don't know what the solutions are. But I don't think it helps quite a bit. I don't think it helps a lot as far as America is concerned, because you can look around the world too, and other nations have that problem. But the solution lies mostly, I think, mainly, you know, in more participation. You know, make it more that, you know, people just have to be judged by, you know, how to play and write on their call. You know, I mean, I know a lot of black people who don't know nothing about any sports at all. I know a lot of white people, you know, who, you know, don't know anything about sports either. So I just don't know what to say, but. It's just like any other job. People have to be judged by what, you know, their performance, the attendance and how they, you know, their dedication and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, but unfortunately, it's very hard to, you know, put that point across. A lot of people still have that, you know, I guess what you've been brought up, what you've been taught. It's like saying somebody's bad all your life, and then you come to find out, well, maybe they aren't so bad at all. But yet still, you've been taught all your life that they're bad, you know, that reinforcement. Or somebody's not good, or they're not intelligent, or something like that. So I don't know. That's how I hang up.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comment. Mr. Hose, you want to react to any of that the caller has said?
Well, he said a lot of things. I certainly think this is just a part of a greater social disease, really. I think sports has a sort of unique personality, and I think it's really more inbred than even other aspects of the entertainment industry. It's basically, one of the main problems is that there has never been a black-owned sports franchise in America in 120 years of professional sport, except for one minor league team down in Savannah for a couple of years. And I think that, there just have not been blacks, with few rare exceptions, in any position to hire and fire, and you tend to hire and fire people who look like you, walk like you, talk like you. You make, it's a series of safe choices. I think it's true in most employment circumstances. But I think it's even worse in sports than in some other places, even in other aspects of the entertainment industry, in the movies. Eddie Murphy and Sidney Poitier at least own their own production companies, and on television there is an Oprah Winfrey, and there is a Bryant Gumbel, and there is a Bill Cosby. You just don't find analogous control in sports.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, the kinds of things that we're talking about are, in a way, again, that's sort of ironic, in the way they're so pervasive that people don't see them. That, you know, for example, when people spend a lot of time talking about and thinking about why it is that there are so few black athletes in certain sports, like swimming or others, you know, there are very few black tennis players or professional golfers, and they spend all this time, you know, asking these questions about why no blacks in these sports, and they seem to tend to overlook the obvious. That is, you know, in the case of swimmers, there aren't a lot of black kids who have access to pools, and in terms of golf, you know, not a lot of black kids who can get to go out to places where you can play. I mean, you've got to have access to the place to do it before you can do it, in addition to, I suppose, it helps to have some role models, you know, to see some people out there that, you know, from whom you get the message, yeah, you can do this too. And it seems that, you know, in certain ways the barriers are pretty obvious, and yet somehow we don't see them.
Oh, it's true. And, you know, in writing this book, I talked to about 100 people, athletes, broadcasters, coaches, administrators, family members. And I tried, rather than just, cranking out statistics and so forth, to really tell stories and to really give a reader a sense of what it feels like to be in these situations. Now, swimming, people might think, what's the big deal? Al Campanis, in his statement, said, you know, why don't you see swimmers, black swimmers? Because they're not buoyant. I mean, here's a sense of a physical limitation keeping blacks from being competent in one of the Earth's few elements, that is water. And I decided, you know, what the heck, let's go try to find some black swimmers. And so I found a team in Cleveland, 25 boys and girls, ages 7 to 18, coached by a black man who for 20 years in Cleveland has been trying to produce good competitive swimmers. And among the other things that he's had to battle, lack of investment in the community and decent pools, lack of role models, no other good coaches, lack of money to provide transportation to meets and even to put good amounts of calories in a swimmer's stomach, was this debilitating ancient stereotype that blacks cannot function in water over their heads. And I talked to one kid, I'll never forget, Warren Moore, who's 10 years old. And he described the sense of intimidation that he feels when he's really the only black swimmer in an all-white suburban pool. And I asked him, I remember in this book, what does it feel like to stand up on the blocks right before a race when you're the only black person? He said, when I'm up on the blocks and I'm the only black person, I feel terrible. If they all beat me, I feel terrible. My coach tells me, don't think about finishing last, just make your times. But when you look around and you're the only black people there, you feel like everybody's giving you the eyeball. Sometimes they say, what are you doing here? Sometimes it's like they don't want to be in the same pool with us. I wish there were more of us. I think a lot of people don't understand how it feels to be in those situations, to be a pioneer, to be a novelty, to feel exotic. It's dampening. It's hard to have a lot of confidence in those situations, and that's another reason why you don't see a lot of black swimmers. I felt it was important to write about that experience.
This morning we're talking with Philip Hose, author of the book Necessities, Racial Barriers in American Sports. It's published by Random House. Our guest is the author of two other books, one of them about Indiana basketball. The title of that book is Hoosiers, The Fabulous Basketball Life of Indiana. He lives in Maine. He takes his title from the book, in case you are curious, from that interview in 1987 in which Al Campanis appeared on the Nightline program. And that interview, which ultimately led to his losing his job, where he was talking with Ted Koppel about why blacks don't participate more in certain sports or in management. And he said, I truly believe blacks may not have some of the necessities to be, let's say, a field manager or a general manager. That's where the title comes from, Necessities. If you have questions, locally, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about a little bit about football. Here was a case. Now, before we were talking about swimming, and there are other sports where black participation is very low. In the football, 62% of the starters in the NFL are black. However, there are certain positions, quarterback, center, where you don't see very many black players. Does it seem to be the case that what is happening is that when these kids are starting out young, participating in sports, maybe high school, maybe even younger, that somebody's telling them that you can't be a quarterback, you can't be a center, there are certain things that you can't, certain positions you just can't play?
Well, usually, you know, I interviewed a number of blacks who had started out in high school, excuse me, at quarterback. Some of them made it through to college and then were dissuaded in the NFL. What they generally get told, rather than that you can't do this, is that you are such a fast runner that it's a shame to waste your speed in such a sedentary position as quarterback. So we're inviting you to try out for defensive back, wide receiver, or running back, and son, if you insist on playing quarterback, two bad things will happen to you. One, either you won't get drafted at all, or you'll be drafted in a very, very low position in the National Football League draft, or you'll find yourself playing quarterback in Canada in the Canadian Football League. And as it turns out, probably 75 to 100 American black football players have played quarterback in the Canadian Football League, a league that only has eight teams in it, whereas in the entire history of the 26-team National Football League, only eight black football players have thrown more than 25 passes from the quarterback position in the history of the league. So it really has to do with, again, the control of the sport. There's never been a black owner. There's never been a black, never been a black general manager. Never been a black head coach in the entire history of the National Football League, even though blacks have participated in that league as players for nearly a half century. Now, it has to do with whites viewing blacks in physical rather than mental terms and not entrusting the control or outcome of a game to black people.
The coaches, the scouts, these people, that somehow they just don't, they can't see a black player in that position. Somehow, just in their mind, they can't see a black quarterback, and somehow it may be at a sort of a subconscious level. They're not consciously keeping them out of that position, maybe, but they're just not thinking about them in that position.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, they're looking for legs. There is the notion that black people can run faster than white people, and speed is an asset in sports. There's no doubt about it. Actually, it's quite an asset at the quarterback position, too, although many of the scouts and coaches just seem to be too slow or too set in their ways to really grasp that. Randall Cunningham of Philadelphia is a great quarterback who happens to be black and is able to run very well and is making that a terrific asset on his team, but he's been given a chance. Most haven't. I think the problem is they're simply not screening black athletes for their ability to lead, inspire, come up with plays, think, command. These traits, mental traits, are simply not being taken into account. They're simply looking at blacks as physical creatures and not as whole human beings.
Mm. You mentioned that Randall Cunningham, he's certainly gotten attention. And a couple of years ago, when the Redskins played in the Super Bowl, Doug Williams, their quarterback, who was black, got a lot of attention, and people said, "Well, you know, maybe this is the beginning now. He's broken some barriers, and more people will think of blacks in that position." You also talk about the fact that now coming up, you are seeing more black quarterbacks playing in high school and college. You think that this is something that will change in the next decade?
I don't see the evidence for it. I think that the Doug Williams game was important in that it did break down some stereotypes. He got hurt and still he played, and there used to be a myth that blacks wouldn't play hurt. He was obviously able to command his team, and he won the big game, and that was a terrifically significant accomplishment. But there were no more black quarterbacks in the National Football League last year than there were before, and if anybody thinks that that attitude has gone away, one needs only to look at the experience of Rodney Pete in last month's NFL draft. Here's a guy who finished second, was voted the second best high school or college player in the country. He was a black quarterback from the University of Southern California and was expected, all the pundits said the night before, to be drafted late in the first round or early in the second. He woke up the next day to find that he had been drafted in the sixth round, the 141st player chosen, with I think it was eight white quarterbacks ahead of him. This idea that there are a lot of black quarterbacks in college and that they soon will break down the door is an old idea. I have a quote from Buddy Young, who was the former assistant to National Football League Commissioner Pete Rozelle. He said this in 1974. Seven of the starting quarterbacks in the Big Ten were black last season. They are proving they can do the job, so it's just a matter of time before we benefit from this in the NFL. That was 15 years ago, and at the time there were two black starting quarterbacks in the NFL. 1987, Pete Rozelle said, "Well, there haven't been too many black pure passers. As we get more and more of them in college, we'll see them in the pros." He said that in 87 when there were three starting quarterbacks in the NFL. So I really don't see the progress. What happens when these black college quarterbacks come into the pros is, again, they get told, "Well, you were the quarterback at a running school. You don't have the experience as a passer. We need a passer. Please play defensive back or go to Canada."
Hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody else here. We got a caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I remember back in high school in the 1940s, about the middle 40s, we had a wrestling coach who had the idea of the anatomy problem here. He said something about hip bones and things like that affected blacks' leverage balance. And I was wondering if your guest knew anything about that sport, the history of that. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's actually a new one to me, hip bones affecting leverage and balance, although I heard one on a talk show the other night where actually an ex-NFL player said that blacks were genetically better equipped to play the tackle position because, as everyone knew, they had better foot balance. I think I've heard just about everything in terms of whites describing blacks. Bones, tendons, nerves, muscles, skull thickness. Black fighters were always said to be better fighters because their skulls were thicker. all the swimming stuff. I just think that there's no end of imagination in this area, and frankly, I think that it's more about the decline of the white athlete, both in the world and against black athletes here in America, than it is about the rise of the black athlete. Whites have given away a lot of turf in sports. It doesn't mean quite as much to a lot of whites as maybe it does to some blacks. Sports has always been the refuge of the poor. I don't know what to say. It's always physical. It's never mental. Hmm.
And you find that you think that there are a lot of black players who believe these things too, that in some ways that they are physically superior and are able to perform better than white players?
I think there are some who believe that. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I don't think it's racist to wonder why there are so many more blacks than whites, say, in the National Football, in the National Basketball Association at all. I simply think that to assume that this is a genetic matter which is linked to race, without a sufficient examination of all the other possible alternatives, where are the white jumpers? We all know that there aren't too many of them playing basketball, but what are they doing instead? Kids who could be jumping, white kids who could be jumping, when they're 10 or 11 years old and so forth, what are they doing instead? Well, some of them are at the mall. There are just a lot of reasons why people excel at athletics. And to attribute these things automatically to racial reasons is to overlook the individual experience.
Let's take another caller here again on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I appreciate this program. I think it's very informative. And I, too, think that there's the element of racism in professional athletics, which I think reflects the racism in society. But I think the guest may be generalizing a bit too much. If he would recall, Ronnie Lott, who played quarterback in college, went on to play defensive back in professional football and is a standout defensive back. Rex Kern out of Ohio State was a quarterback, and when he was drafted to play pro ball, they told him that if he wanted to make it, he would have to be a defensive back. Ronnie Lott is black, Rex Kern is white. I fail to see how the argument is enhanced by just painting a broad brush, saying that all these moves affecting black quarterbacks in college is somehow tied into a racist mindset in professional sports.
I think that the only thing that you really can say about it, since you really have a hard time getting coaches to say that they believe blacks are not competent to control games, is to look at patterns, is to look at how long football has been played in America, how long blacks have played in the game, and how few have played quarterback and center with respect and offensive guard with respect to the other positions. And also, I think it's useful to contrast the experience of Canadian football, where this pattern hasn't existed at all.
Well, I understand your patterns, but what I'm saying is, when you break it down to specific instances, I don't think that you could claim that every time a quarterback from college who happens to be black goes to pro, that there's an incident of racism. I'm just not sure that sweeping generalization can be made, because there are instances, in fact, two of which I just named involving different races, where these were decisions made by coaches.
Well, I just have to say that I haven't made that claim. I have not said that every time that a black ends up playing defensive back who played quarterback in college, racism was at work.
And also, I think I get the feeling you're a bit on shaky ground when you compare Canadian football to football, professional balls played in the United States. I think they're two vastly different games. if all you have to do is watch them. In some cases, the rules are a bit different. And, you know, is there something about the Canadian game that you're plugging into that maybe you're disenchanted with in the American style of playing?
Well, the game is a little bit different. The field is a bit bigger. That's the main thing. I don't think they have first downs in Canadian football. I think those are the two main differences. But when I've interviewed Canadians about this, there has been the suggestion by a few people that I talked to that the Canadian game promotes running, and therefore, since it's widely believed that blacks can outrun whites, that there's a premium on runners there. But most of the people associated with Canadian football that I talked to about this matter believed that it was a function of racism. What can I say? I went out and interviewed them, and that's their opinion.
I understand that, and I'm agreeing with you in the broader terms, but I think, you know, where I'm having difficulty with this is when I look at specific cases, because the case was made in the Italian background in America as well, that they were good fighters because they fought their way out of the Italian neighborhoods. Well, clearly that's incorrect. But to say that that each individual who fought his way out of the ghetto did so because he happened to be of that heritage, I just think you get very on very shaky ground when you start looking at the specific instances.
Well, in the book, I did write about a number of specific instances where the people involved believed racial prejudice was at work. And I don't think that if you make a generalization about something, it's necessary to describe every single incident that has ever happened in order to support it. I think to everything you can say, there are exceptions. And, I guess that's what I have to say, although I would agree with your comment about other ethnic groups being affected. I mean, there was a time when professional basketball was dominated by Jews, and there were many explanations given. Ed Sullivan, who gave us the Beatles and Elvis, was a columnist before that, and he wrote in one of his columns, "Jewish players seem to take naturally to the game of basketball. Perhaps this is because the Jew is a natural gambler who will take chances. Maybe it's because he devotes himself more closely to a problem than others will. Whatever the reason, the fact remains that some of the greatest stars of today are Jewish players." And then after Jews got out of some of those neighborhoods and did a little bit better and Catholics moved in, then it was the tough, the Irish, or the Catholic or Italian immigrant who were naturally tougher and more aggressive, and that was what did it. And in fact, in boxing, boxing was originally dominated by English people. After they became well established, all the fighters became Irish. It was, kid this and kid that. And when the Irish got a foothold, the Irish names continued, even though the boxers weren't Irish. New Irish fighters were a lot of times Jews, and they had adopted Irish names just to profit from that popularity. Battling Johnny Kilrain II was maybe Hyman Finkel or Seth Rosenthal or something like that. So, I don't know, I agree with you on that.
We have a little bit less than 10 minutes left. We're talking with Philip Hose, the author of the book Necessities, Racial Barriers in American Sports. If you'd like to call in, maybe you have questions, comments, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I want to get into an area that we have not talked about yet, and that is the management side of things. In your book, you write, "By far the most important statistic in the history of black participation in sports is that since 1869, no black person has ever owned even a share of a major league sports team in America." And it's not for lack of interest or for lack of means. Certainly there are three players that you, former players that you name, and I'm sure that there are others, who have the interest and have the money to have a team, those being Walter Payton, Reggie Jackson, and Julius Irving. So they're out there, they have the money, and certainly it's not cheap, and they have the interest, but why is it they don't have the teams?
Well, I think that the reasons have changed a little bit. I think before the late 60s, let's say, there just weren't very many blacks with enough money even who could form a group. I think capital was the main limitation. Capital and prejudice, I think, worked hand in hand. It takes a lot of money, and even then it took a lot of money to buy a sports team. Now I think that situation has changed. There are a number of black millionaires. There are groups that can form to make a good, credible bid on a sports team. There's been one group of which Gale Sayers has been a part that for the last 8 or 9 years has been trying to buy an NFL franchise. There was a real good bid on the San Antonio Spurs, which was headed by a group formed by Bertrand Lee, who's a black entrepreneur from Boston recently. There was a case in the early 80s where a group that was 40% minority owned and headed by Don Clendenin, who was an ex-baseball star, actually got a 90-day option on the Oakland Athletics. They inquired of the owners rather discreetly what percentage of minority ownership would be appropriate or would be acceptable, that is, to you, and the attorney for the owners group came back, according to Clendenin, with the figure of 10%. They then decided not to fight it and simply didn't exercise the option. I think that there is some resistance in professional sports to minority ownership. It's a very, very conservative group of people, and that's really what's going to make a change if anything ever does. It's surrendering the power of the purse strings.
It's the other owners that don't want blacks among their numbers and in their clubs, so to speak.
Well, I mean, the evidence would sure show that. I mean, given over the last couple decades, the volume of credible bids and the absolute lack of success. I mean, maybe this is just your last caller again saying you can't point to a pattern. But if the pattern is so total, where there are simply no exceptions and a decent volume of applications, then I think you do have to. That does suggest prejudice, and I have no doubt that it exists.
We're growing kind of short on time here. I have another caller that I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk to here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I was want to comment briefly on another factor in the management, and that is the whole issue of blacks, athletes, and college education. Well, there might be a perception that blacks go to college as a way to getting into pro sports, and that really they don't get the kind of quality education that others get because they're given a free ride or they're not expected to perform academically. Thinking a little bit along the lines of the Nick Anderson case where it seems that education wasn't really his goal, and right or wrong, is that perception out there, and could that account for the fact that, well, gee, if they really had a quality education, they could be managers and owners, but they really go through 4 years and don't get the education that others get?
Well, that perception may or may not be out there, but if education were a real criterion for access into management, then Yogi Berra or Casey Stengel or, you know, I don't know what Don Zimmer's education has been, but it hasn't had much to do. The people that get those jobs are poorly educated people for the most part, and it's a double standard.
We just we're as I say, coming down to the wire here. One of the things that you do point out in your book, the fact that now in baseball, when Bart Giamatti was picked to replace Peter Eberroth as the commissioner, a black man, his name is Bill White, was picked to replace Giamatti as president of the National League, and this is a significant development here. Do you think that has the potential for changing some things, not only in baseball, but in sports, in all of sports?
Not that in and of itself. Again, I think what it'll take to change anything is black ownership or minority ownership. But I do think it's a significant event. I think it's a sort of a cultural statement on baseball's part that they're at least willing to envision a person with black or brown skin in a decision-making role. So I think that was good. But I don't think that in and of itself is going to change much.